For our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service provides the following program. The Indie Week. This is the Independent, read by John Feddersen. Today, the issue, April the 2nd of 2026. Well, we begin in the state legislature. Who will succeed Greg Mayer in the Senate? The choice may fall to two Orange County residents. This article, second term State Senator Greg Mayer is vacating his seat to take a job as executive director of the North Carolina Justice Center. Four candidates, including State Representative Alan Buonsi, State Representative Renee Price, and State Democratic Party Vice Chair Jonah Garson, are vying to finish Mayer's term and replace him on the November ballot. The replacement process is admittedly a bit squirrely, says Orange County Democratic Party Chair Lynn McGee. Under North Carolina law and Democratic Party procedures, the seat will not go to a special election, but will be filled by a committee consisting of two delegates from each county in the district, and that's Caswell, Orange, and Person County in this case. The committee will meet this Saturday in a public virtual meeting to make their pick for Mayer's successor, and the new senator will be sworn in no more than a week later, well before the short session starts in late April. The members of that committee are picked in regular elections at county party conventions, independent of any vacancy that needs filling. It just so happens this year that Mayer's resignation and the elections to the committee to appoint his replacement happened in the same month, adding some contention to an ordinarily unnewsworthy process. Delegates to the Orange Convention this weekend even amended the rules to compel committee members to announce who they were planning to vote for, but none would announce a decision, said McGee. I know people were frustrated, but you can't waterboard someone to make them tell who they're going to vote for. Local politicos had eyes on Orange County's committee selection in particular because committee members' votes are weighted by population. Orange's two delegates each get 246 votes. Persons each get 65. Caswell's each gets 38. That means the Orange County committee members, if they agree on a candidate or even if one picks up an ally in another county, can handily control the vote. Kenneth Woods, one of those Orange County king or queen makers, told Indy that he would favor, quote, someone that's intelligent, someone that's a leader, someone that will speak out against wrongs, unquote, but declined to name a name. Quote, it's going to be a fair election. It's going to be fair, it's going to be open, and there's not going to be any hanky-panky from anyone. Indy attempted to reach Orange County's other committee member, Bonnie Bevan, but hadn't heard back as of this article. The three candidates from Orange County, the State Party Vice Chair Garson, and State House Representatives Buonsi and Price, likely have an advantage over Kenneth Perry, who serves on several local government boards in Person County. Given Orange's massive vote share on the committee and their name recognition. Like a lot of Orange County politics, the short campaign for this appointment feels like a fairly polite family argument. Price was elected to Mayer's former House seat in 2022, and he ran for the Senate seat he's now vacating. Price and Buonsi served together on the House now. Garson and Buonsi previously ran against each other for Buonsi's current House seat. Since waterboarding is apparently discouraged, it's difficult to say who Woods and his counterparts will pick on Saturday to fill the seat, but Garson in particular may have sought an upper hand by moving aggressively to lock down endorsements from many local Democratic Party notables and flood his website and social media with that evidence. The appointment, he told Indy, quote, is about fielding the best team of complementary strengths and experiences and maintaining seniority where we can for that collective progressive strength. And that means keeping Representatives Bwanzi and Price where they are in the House. Garson said, I have deep relationships across all three of these counties. I know these counties, and I know rural North Carolina well from organizing all across the state. When our local jurisdictions are trying to do the best with the resources they have, we just have to have a legislator who brings in an organizer's orientation, perspective, and experience. Bwanzi, if he doesn't win the Senate seat, is likely to have easy re-election to his House seat in November. He told the Indy that his Senate candidacy is built around his experience advocating for rural parts of the state, especially as a lawyer in the UNC Center for Civil and Human Rights. And he said, I feel like I'm uniquely situated to hit the ground running. He cited the need for steady hands amid the recent upheaval in the Senate. With the intra-party usurpation of Phil Berger, the state's most powerful lawmaker until recently, quote, I've been spending a lot of time just talking with people across the state Senate district so folks can get a feel for who I am, but also so that I can learn from them about what's important to them. Price was first elected to Orange County Commission in 2012 before her election to the House in 22 and easily fended off a primary challenger this month. She told Indy her campaign is built on her record as a fighter for freedom and justice, even though, quote, it's difficult to actually make progress, unquote, in the state legislature's Democratic minority. For example, she's touted her bill to honor the Tuskegee Airmen, which passed unanimously in the House but is stalled in the Senate. She said, we're a long way from a judicious system here in the U.S., when we see people being incarcerated without fair trial, when we see women's rights being taken away from us, LGBT rights, she added. Well, our feature-length story will come up after this, but first we got to hear from Luke DeCock, unexpected addition from over from the News and Observer land. A sports columnist, and this article is all about Will Wade, the departed coach from North Carolina State, who was very, very quickly relieved of his duties at the end of this first basketball season as the coach. And Luke DeCock writes, at the end of a week of unprecedented coaching turmoil in the Triangle, the shockwaves were still reverberating a time zone away. At the Midwest Regional of the NCAA basketball tournament in Chicago, with nary an Atlantic Coast Conference school in sight, three of the four coaches were considered potential candidates for the newly opened job at UNC Chapel Hill, and the fourth was the one guy who would never, ever get it. The first question for Alabama's Nate Oates on Thursday was about UNC. Iowa State's T.J. Otzelberger was also asked about that vacancy. Michigan's Dusty May was not, but there were murmurings in the hallway about UNC's potential interest in him. Tennessee's Rick Barnes, who remains persona non grata in Chapel Hill decades after his famous feud with Dean Smith, was asked as well, but only as a joke. Hey, I'm from North Carolina, said Barnes, a Hickory native, well aware of his history with the Tar Heels. He did, however, make an effort to tout his assistant coach, Justin Gainey, a former NC State player, for the Wolfpack's sudden vacancy after Will Wade stepped down to Louisiana State. He skipped town. With Duke, the overall number one seed in the men's tournament, the state continues to exert an extraordinary gravitational pull on college basketball. Last week's developments, though, highlighted just how much the game has changed. Wade ditched NC State like a con man fleeing a town he just sold a monorail. Hubert Davis was cut loose from his dream job by the university he loved. Their departures came under divergent circumstances, just as their personalities and approaches to coaching could not have been more different. Wade arrived and departed Raleigh as the ultimate mercenary in his schlubby tracksuits, building a roster from spare parts in the transfer portal. Davis emulated his predecessor, Roy Williams, not only in a plaid blazer, but in trying to build around those blue-chip recruits that fueled UNC's greatest success in previous eras. They are united, however, as cogs in the modern college sports machine, where everything is expendable, loyalty is worthless, and there's a price tag on everything and everyone. That didn't happen by accident. It's the culmination of years of intransigence from people who benefited from a flawed system, and now the impact is landing on everyone. That includes Barnes, who greatly appreciated the humor and the very notion of him wearing Carolina blue. That exchanged, when transcribed by the NCAA's excellent stenographers and unavoidably stripped of nuance, managed to irritate the kind of Carolina fans who like to complain about things on message boards. Not coincidentally, Barnes also had some words of warning for UNC. Just because you used to be a basketball powerhouse, it does not mean things are still that way. He said, "The obvious problem today is there's some fan bases that still think they have an entitlement, and they think it's going to be the same way. The game has changed totally because of NIL. I know Hubert. He was the very first player I started recruiting as a head coach back at George Mason. Incredible coach. I don't care where he would be. Everything that's good about the game, he is about it." Still, it's hard to argue that Davis was meeting the standards the Heels have set over the decades. There's something to be said for trying to stick by those, especially if the alternative is admitting defeat and abandoning them entirely. Davis reluctantly hired a general manager last season, becoming one of the last major programs to outsource what are essentially contract negotiations with recruits and transfers away from the coaching staff. He seemed unable to navigate the admittedly treacherous waters of the modern college game, insisting on multiple occasions that UNC, quote, is not a transactional program. Except today, everything is, even in the case of Wade, the coach himself. Wade first became infamous during the FBI's investigation into corruption in college basketball in 2019. A probe that seemed promising but fizzled into a few minor prosecutions of assistant coaches and recruiting fixers, scapegoated for the crimes of their superiors. A wiretap caught Wade discussing a strong-ass offer to a player, something that is the way things are done now but was still against the rules then. When he arrived at State last March, he joked that the game had finally caught up with his methods. Here, to be sure, was a man for the moment. But the pieces of his expensively assembled roster never fit, and his public demeanor rankled State fans when things turned sour. When LSU, the school that had fired him when he was caught on that wiretap, showed up with a strong-ass offer, he turned tail and ran at the first opportunity. The strength of the wolf may be in the pack and so on, but Wade was more in line with a different parable, the leopard and his spots. NC State bought him. He bought a roster, and someone else made a better offer. Cash is king. Both of these changes, the coach for sale to the highest bidder, the loyalist abandoned for failing to meet standards he helped set, are symptoms of bigger problems in college athletics, which has poorly managed its transition from extracurricular activity to multi-billion-dollar business. For decades, college athletics was a simple economy. A full scholarship was considered fair payment for what athletes brought to the university, Coaches and athletic directors made a decent living, and the NCAA exerted tremendous power and control over all of them. They were still recruiting, and academic scandals, and the Ivy League voluntarily backed away from big-time football in the 1950s after playing a dominant role in the sport. But for the most part, the books balanced themselves. Then, the television money started to bloom slowly at first, then exponentially, pushing at the seams of the principles of amateurism, exemplified by the NCAA's chosen verbiage of student-athlete. Coaches and administrators started making millions, not to mention construction firms. All that money had to go somewhere because it couldn't go to the athletes, so it went to adult staffers and gold-plated facilities instead. You couldn't entice recruits with money, so you built a football facility with the lazy river, barbershop, mini-golf course, and a flight simulator. The NCAA fought a two-fisted legal battle against any player who sought a piece of the revenue they helped generate, and the first water started to trickle through the dam when the California legislature legalized what we now know as NIL in 2019. That allowed players, if you didn't know, to capitalize on their name, image, and likeness rights by not only doing advertisements and endorsements, but acting in movies, recording albums, and hosting summer camps, all of which had been prohibited under the guise of amateurism. Legislators elsewhere, fearful of losing recruits who would otherwise have played at State U, quickly followed suit. Then, Governor Roy Cooper did it in North Carolina by executive order in July of 2021. It was merely the first blow against the NCAA's strict interpretation of amateur athletics. More would soon follow in waves. Never mind that the Olympic movement long ago abandoned that pretense in all but name. This was the hill that NCAA would die on, and it died. The Supreme Court's 2021 decision, Alston versus NCAA, was relatively minor in scope. It allowed universities to pay the athletes the, quote, cost of attendance stipends to cover housing, books, and the like, but it was written in a way that indicated the NCAA wasn't going to lose any similar case it faced. Last spring, it finally chose to fold rather than fight a lawsuit from Arizona State's swimmer Grant House and other athletes who argued the NCAA's amateurism rules were an antitrust violation, essentially setting the cost of labor at $0 unilaterally. In addition to billions of dollars in back pay for former athletes, the House settlement opened the door to schools paying current athletes directly, a pool of $20.5 million per year per school in revenue sharing. Had the NCAA acted more proactively earlier, all this might have proceeded in a more orderly fashion. Instead, lawsuit after lawsuit tore apart the NCAA's old rule book. Athletes no longer had to sit out a year when changing schools and could do it as often as they liked. Between revenue sharing and school-arranged NIL deals, every college athlete became a free agent, open for business. Professional leagues have collective bargaining agreements to govern these things. The NCAA, because it so badly botched its legal strategy, had no recourse but to make the best deal it could with the House plaintiffs. So that's where we are now, with the NCAA begging Congress, so far unsuccessfully, for a get-out-of-jail-free card. Outgoing UNC Athletic Director Bubba Cunningham is one of many power brokers who now argue publicly that collective bargaining with athletes is the best path forward, but it may take years for the rest of the college sport industrial complex to come around to that idea. Amid all this upheaval, college sports are probably no more broken than they ever were, players, at least, are no longer unpaid labor, and the dysfunction is out in the open instead of in the shadows. Fans may complain, but they're still watching. Television ratings have never been higher. Fears that some of the core aspects of college fandom are being lost, like watching a player develop over the course of his or her career, and building bonds with a school that endure long after graduation, have so far proven unfounded, or at least not had an impact yet. Nevertheless, it's jarring to see UNC conducting a coaching search outside its family for the first time in 70 years after firing a member of that family, let alone witness the utter venality of someone like Wade on full display. When things change in college basketball, North Carolina often feels it first, and deeply. Well, the feature article, if you can call it that, The Life and Tragic Death of Eleanor Rush, about a death in prison from a woman more than 70 years ago. It's a long article, probably take about at least 10, 15 minutes to read. More than 70 years ago, Eleanor Rush would not stop screaming. Officials at the women's prison, where she was serving a six-month sentence, put her in a restraining belt, using painful mechanical cuffs known as iron claws on her wrists and gagging her with towels. She was later found dead from a crushed spine caused by a dislocated neck. Her death sparked a nearly four-hour rebellion among 350 black and white inmates, the first major protest at that all-women's prison, which had been established in the 1930s. State and federal probes followed, including one called by the state coroner. In September of 1954, a nearly all-white jury declined to hold state prison officials accountable and blamed Rush for her own death, calling her, quote, incorrigible. Her mother sued state officials and won $3,000. And in response to Rush's death, state prison officials permanently banned the practice of gagging. Rush was an example of the unrelenting sexist and racist treatments thousands of black women endured in North Carolina prisons and across the country in the 1950s. But over the years, her name has been largely forgotten. The Civil Rights Cold Case Records Review Board hopes to change that. The National Board, a nonpartisan panel of private citizens appointed by the president, is empowered to release records of federal investigations into unresolved cases from the civil rights era. Those cases cover the period between January 1, 1940 and December 31, 1979, and deal with incidents of anti-black violence. Since October 2024, the board has released records in 44 cases, including files on Emmett Till, that 14-year-old black Chicago boy abducted and lynched in Mississippi during the summer of 55. In January, the board released 63 pages of federal records stemming from the FBI's investigation into the Rush case, including newspaper clippings, correspondence, and case files. Congress created this board through legislation it passed in late 2018 when President Donald Trump signed into law in early 2019. That board expires in 2027, but pending legislation in Congress would extend its work for another 4 years. The board has released records in three North Carolina cases, including Rush. Margaret Burnham, a board member and former chair, is also the founder of the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project at Northeastern University School of Law. That project has the most comprehensive archive of anti-black killings in the country, including Rush. Her story is important for a number of reasons, said Burnham. When most people think of the civil rights movement, they think of the marches, the civil disobedience, the good trouble, Burnham said. But the flame of protest was also lit in prisons and jails where there were no TV cameras, she added. We can't grasp the fuller legacy of the movement without taking on the Eleanor Rushes, for she and all the women who protested her death were making larger claims about black humanity and women's rights. Search newspaper clippings and you won't find an image of Eleanor Rush. In fact, you won't find much about her life before prison, but you will find clues. She was born in 1936 in Stanley County. According to her death certificate, her parents were Waddell Rush and Geneva Winchester. Her mother would later change her last name to Gould after she married another man. Eleanor dropped out of school and worked as a domestic servant. She spent most of her life with her mother, but at times lived with her grandmother and a man named Jesse Clark, her father's cousin. Waddell Rush died before Eleanor reached her teenage years. At a hearing involving her lawsuit, Gould said Eleanor told her she had married, but there don't seem to be any records of the marriage. She never had children. Rush reportedly told an interviewer at the prison that she was dependent on welfare, lacked food and clothing, and was ashamed of being poor, according to an August Raleigh News and Observer article of 1954. Rush also says Gould's new husband made passes at her. She had her first brush with the law at 16, charged with fornication and adultery, according to the article. She was jailed, but it's not clear for how long. In 1953, she was sent for the first time to women's prison on a conviction of public drunkenness and disturbing the peace and sentenced to 6 months. Within a week, officials transported her to Caledonia Prison Farm in Halifax County, which had been built on a former slave pen plantation. The prison farm didn't have a good reputation. A black prisoner lost both legs after being locked in one of the heatless shacks, according to an August 54 article in the Black Weekly in Norfolk, Virginia. These prison farms were more akin to slave plantations, said Robert Chase, associate history professor at Stony Brook University and author of We Are Not Slaves, State Violence, Coerced Labor, and Prisoners' Rights in Postwar America. And at these prison farms, he said, black women were subjected to hard labor and severe punishment. While at Caledonia, Rush allegedly tried to kill a prison matron who supervised female prisoners. In 1953, she was taken to the state psychiatric hospital in Goldsboro for evaluation. Officials there concluded, quote, hers was not a mental but a disciplinary problem. In February, she was back at women's prison in Raleigh, where she served out the rest of that sentence. 2 months later, though, she returned to another six-month sentence for forcible trespassing. Gould testified when she last saw her daughter alive before her second stint at women's prison, she was healthy. She was my baby and last child, she said. Women's prison was the only female correctional facility in the state, located on 30 acres in Raleigh. Today, the North Carolina Correctional Institution for Women is on that same site on Bragg Street, with a capacity to house 1,776 women. A second, smaller facility for women is in Buncombe County. As a black woman, Rush faced the brutal double whammy of racism and sexism in the Jim Crow era. Like other southern states, the North Carolina prison system was set up to keep black people separate, unequal, and oppressed, said Chase. And though black women made up a small portion of the total prison population, they were on the receiving end of the most egregious punishment. Chase said Rush's treatment was typical of what black women experienced in southern prisons. Black women also had little to no legal means to protest the condition or their treatment, he said. They couldn't file federal lawsuits and had little chance of successfully filing legal challenges in state courts. A month after she started her second sentence, she was placed in the isolation ward for 57 days for what state prison officials said was disruptive behavior, including using profanity, destroying property, and assaulting inmates and prison officers, according to court and FBI records and news articles. She lasted 8 days in the general population before state prison officials threw her back in isolation on the 14th. And on August 20th, Russia's seventh day in solitary, state prison officials alleged she wouldn't stop screaming and cursing. Mabel Wright, a black inmate confined to a cell across from Rush, later told authorities that she and Rush were screaming because prison officials had not fed them since at least 7 a.m. that day. Rush was in a 7-by-9-foot cell with a floor mattress, a toilet, and reinforced windows. Prison officials said they gave her sparse furnishings because Rush had previously destroyed property. At 9 p.m., Hazel Anderson, an on-duty nurse, called prison superintendent Ivan Hinton, who was at home across the street. He arrived at the prison an hour later. Hinton, Anderson, and four guards went to the isolation ward and told Wright and Rush to quiet down. Hinton tried to contact the prison physician to see if the doctor could give the women something to sleep, although he later said he never reached the doctor. At the recommendation of Assistant Superintendent Helen Reinhardt, he decided to gag Wright and Rush. Hinton, Anderson, and the four guards returned to the ward, and Hinton later said two of the guards placed an iron claw or a mechanical cuff on Rush. Hinton put her in a restraining belt and then inserted a towel in her mouth while a guard tied the belt around her back. They left and went to Wright's cell to administer the same punishment, and after they finished, they saw Rush had managed to remove the gag, and she reportedly said, according to a summary by the Civil Rights Records Review Board, "You ain't done a goddamn thing to me." They opened Rush's cell. Hinton asked for a second towel, and while two guards held her arm, a third wedged in two gags, one between her teeth and another on top of her teeth, just like a bit in a mule's mouth. Hinton said later that Rush was backing up and twisting and shaking her head every way. The guard who gagged Rush insisted he never touched Rush's head. Well, and at 11:30 p.m., she was found unresponsive, her face on the floor and her legs on the mattress. According to news accounts, a medical student declared her death. Her death certificate says she died at midnight on August 21st following an, quote, accident. The certificate says, quote, she apparently bumped head against the wall. Rex Hospital pathologist Renee Hadre did the autopsy and determined that the guards and Hinton had dislocated Rush's neck while gagging her. He said in the report and later testified in court, there were two possibilities. The dislocation of the neck and compression of the spinal cord happened at the same time, or the spinal cord compression happened soon after. If it happened at the same time, prison officials would have immediately noticed, he added. Regardless, once her spinal cord was crushed, she would have quickly gone limp and died, he said. One thing was clear. Rush's fatal injuries were not self-inflicted. News of the death spread quickly within the prison, and the next morning of August 21st, Wright called out to other female inmates, most of whom were playing softball and relaxing outside, that Rush had been, quote, cruelly treated by prison officials before her death. The prison's 350 inmates, 200 black, 150 white, rebelled. At least 30 inmates confronted a prison supervisor demanding answers. The prison matron, apparently Reinhardt, the assistant superintendent, barricaded herself in a building. She told the inmates Rush had a heart attack. She later said at a hearing that she didn't know that, but said she was merely repeating what she heard from someone else. Reinhardt said she ran into a building and called Hinton, and then the uprising began in earnest. News and Observer reporter Jim Rankin wrote, the women merged into one large group, yelling, screaming, pressed against the wire fence near the front gate. Many of the women shouted, "They killed Eleanor!" Guards from the nearby all-male central prison arrived, got the inmates into their cell blocks. Eight women, four black and four white, were identified as ringleaders, and they acted as spokespersons when prison's director, William Bailey, arrived. One of the women, Elise Jackson, had jumped over the back fence and run down three city blocks before officials captured her. "They killed my cousin," she told the director, according to the article. Jackson and three other black inmates were taken to Caledonia Prison Farm. It wasn't clear what happened to the white women, who were also identified as ringleaders. As Jackson said between two guards waiting to be transported, she said the women's prison was a nice place, but the people ain't nice, according to the article in the NNO. A former inmate told the New Journal and Guide, that's a black newspaper in Norfolk, Virginia, that Rush's death was not the only reason why inmates rebelled. She said what those women did out there in the yard in the cell houses was just their way of showing they were fed up with the entire mess. The girl's death was just a cap to set off the charges already buried deep in the souls of the inmates. Newspaper editorials condemned Rush's death, while a column in the Asheville Citizen-Times called her a, quote, worthless person. The writer concluded, Eleanor did not deserve to die. Less than a month later, the Wake County coroner ordered an investigation into the circumstances of the death. A jury of five white men, including two former Raleigh mayors and one black man, was convened. 45 inmates testified at the hearing. Mabel Wright told the jurors she saw what happened through a crack under her cell door. She said she saw prison officials gag Rush and then tie her to the mattress. She also claimed she heard a slapping sound. FBI investigators said in a report it would have been impossible for Wright to see into another isolation cell through the door crack. Several inmates testified they had not heard Rush screaming or making any excessive noise from the isolation ward the night she died, according to hearing transcripts. Some also testified state prison officials appeared to have moved Rush's mattress out of her cell and near the boiler room, and they saw blood on it. Others said they didn't know where the mattress came from, according to a September 9, 1954 article in the Atlanta Daily World. Elise Jackson testified she was placed in Rush's cell hours after Rush had died and that she saw blood on the floor. The jury's verdict blamed Rush for her death, calling her, quote, incorrigible and very difficult to control. Rush had died, quote, due to her violent efforts against necessary restraint while they were being applied and in her subsequent struggle to remove them. They ruled after 40 minutes of deliberation. Hinton and the four guards were never criminally charged, but the State Bureau of Investigation launched a probe and found that state prison officials were negligent. The FBI also became involved after the agency's director, J. Edgar Hoover, sent along a Daily Worker article about the case to the Justice Department's Criminal Division. The FBI's Charlotte field office began its investigation in September of 1954. And the coroner, interviewing Superintendent Bailey and the coroner and reviewing Rush's prison records and autopsy. Then it forwarded its report to Julian Gaskell, the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of North Carolina. Gaskell concluded there was no civil rights violation. An FBI office memorandum says in penciled handwriting the facts of the case, quote, are just as consistent with innocence as with guilt of a civil rights violation. Gould Rush's mother filed legal claims against state prison officials alleging their negligence led to her daughter's death. She sought $58,000 in damages. The North Carolina Industrial Commission, which adjudicates claims of negligence against state officials, took up the case. In the end, they awarded Gould $3,000, ruling that Hinton and other state prison officials were negligent and had violated prison regulations by gagging Rush. Deputy Hearing Commissioner Hugh M. Curran wrote Hinton had, quote, failed to give Eleanor Rush the protection and care required by law. Well, the state appealed, but the North Carolina Supreme Court upheld that decision. Several months after Rush's death, State prison leaders changed their policies to explicitly ban the practice of gagging, and Hinton resigned the following summer. Russia's name was splashed across front pages of newspaper around the country in the mid-1950s. The black press, including Baltimore's Afro-American and Norfolk's New Journal and Guide, covered her case extensively. Then her name faded from headlines until recently. Sarah Merlo, a North Carolina native, discovered Rush about 2 years ago while working as an education consultant for Northeastern's Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project. Merlo, who is white, became invested in the project after learning more about her own family's history and entanglement with racism. She learned that her great-grandfather, who had been a justice of the peace in Mississippi at the height of Jim Crow, had exonerated another justice of the peace who had murdered a black man in 1953. She looked through the project's archive, which includes information on more than 50 incidents of anti-black violence in North Carolina. She narrowed her research to 9 cases, one of which was Rush. Her case stood out for 2 reasons. Rush was young, and she was a woman. Her death and the aftermath also followed the predictable patterns of Jim Crow violence, particularly in the South, Merlo said. That included the lack of accountability. In Rush's case, the state legislature authorized paying state's prisons officials legal bills, said Merlo. A News and Observer article from 1955 said General Assembly had initially considered reimbursing Hinton and the 4 guards $1,500 in legal expense, but ultimately agreed to only $500. Chase, the history professor, said that in the years following Rush's death, prison rebellions grew as inmates across the country became increasingly frustrated with the conditions. That held true in North Carolina. In 1956, 18 inmates at women's prison protested their living conditions and the lack of hot food. During the uprising, they freed a fellow inmate, Zora Farrow, from the prison hospital, smashing a glass door and pushing a prison nurse out of the way, according to an article in the North Carolina Historical Review. Nationally, prison uprisings increased steadily through the late 60s and early 70s, reaching a peak of 48 in 1972, said Chase. Women staged a 5-day rebellion at the prison in 1975 over living conditions. With new legal protections, Joan Little, a black woman, won acquittal that same year for killing a Beaufort County jail guard. She said she stabbed the guard after he tried to rape her. Burnham, the former chair of the Cold Case Records Review Board, said the records on Rush are significant beyond reporting the details of her death. They also show the extent to which people sought to condemn Rush and blame her for her death, as well as the efforts of her fellow inmates and her mother to find a, quote, larger meaning in her life and tragic death. She said, the records remind us of the multiple vulnerabilities of young black women. We're left to question what went wrong with the system that failed her at every turn. All right, who amongst our listeners remembers the hit movie musical Grease? Well, one day, several years ago, a married couple, Henry Cloud Andrade and Crystal Lightning, found themselves watching this 1978 movie. It sparked a conversation. Andrade, a Wixárika writer and rapper, that's, by the way, spelled Wixárika. I have not heard that term. We talked about how, for a rock and roll movie, is a very white movie. We were like, what if there's a native Grease? What would that look like? We talked about the obvious reasons why that wouldn't exist. The 50s were a lot different for indigenous peoples. We were dealing with boarding schools and residential schools and the 60s scoop. As they continued watching, the Grease tune Summer Nights came on, and the couple began riffing lyrics like, met a girl, she's Enoch Cree, met a boy who's not related to me. We started cracking up, said Andrade. Since that day, those ad-lib lyrics have been sung many hundreds of times as part of the show they inspired, Bear Grease, a parody musical that infuses the story and songs of Greece with indigenous traditions and hip-hop. The performance comes to Durham today, April the 2nd and the 3rd. That will be when this show is aired. So, folks, you're paying attention to this particular article. Duke Arts Presents. It's their closer of their season. At first, the all-Indigenous cast included Undred and Lightning themselves. Lightning, an actor and director from the Enoch Cree Nation in Alberta, Canada. I'd never gotten to play a role like Sandy as an Indigenous woman. These roles were not available to us, so we had to create them for ourselves. But these days, the creators, known together as the hip-hop group Lightning Cloud, take a backstage role in the show, which has toured extensively and recently ran off-Broadway. Now, the Indies spoke to Lightning and Andrade about Bear Grease, the meaning behind the name, and the many references to Indigenous culture they wove into the show. All right, this is a Q&A form. Question, you've been touring this show for over 4 years. What do you think makes it resonate so deeply? Andrade, what it represents is what makes it big. Natives being able to see themselves on stage and our white friends and allies being able to see us as humans and watch us fall in love and goof around. We've also incorporated original music, hip-hop, pow-wow. There's all this language and culture that people would never see on a theater stage. And Cloud, I think it's really needed because it's funny, and a lot of Native stories are based on our past, which is very traumatic. Although that's important and we acknowledge it, we decided laughter is medicine. We wanted to go the other way and create something fun and joyous. Question, can you explain the significance of Bear Grease in Indigenous culture? Andrade's, Bear Grease comes from the rendered fat of a bear. It's a sacred medicine. You can heal anything from scrapes to your hair, your skin, your heart. We took on the name Bear Grease, not just to play on grease, but also to mean that we come with this healing message. The audience will leave in laughter and in tears, feeling well represented, having to been able to live their lives and whatever they're going to for 2.5 hours and disappear into our world. When you're touring Bear Grease, are you able to connect with local Native communities? We make it a point to. We do community shows, which are the heart and soul of this, because that's where we get to make an impact on the youth. We'll offer a workshop or a Q&A. It's so important for our youth to see this representation. We also have a couple of lines in the show we tailor to the community. Usually, Danny and his crew are from the local tribe, so everywhere we go, the whole crew learns the greeting, learns about the tribe, all those little things that really connect us. And usually, Sandy comes from a tribe that's nearby they have a healthy beef with. The crowd goes nuts when they hear their nation. Finally, can you share a few elements of Indigenous culture that audiences will see in Bear Grease? Andrade, you'll see traditional grass dance we use in our powwow culture. You'll see the traditional fancy dance. You'll see the famous Métis jigging. You'll see dress, our style, our braids, our beadwork. There's a Native humor that we use which connects directly with Natives, but also is so funny that everyone will enjoy it. We incorporate ledger art, which is a beautiful traditional Indigenous medium of making art on ledger paper. There's our language. We have a song called Wichithin, which is a Cree rendition of Stand By Me. That's usually the one that leaves everyone in tears. Cloud says, we do hopelessly devoted to you, but it's sung roundy style. In our culture, the roundy is our version of the blues. You'll hear it at the 49, which is the after party of powwows. our 50s. Poodle skirts have ribbons and beads and bears and beadwork on them and bears. It's not the T-Birds. It's the Thunderbirds. The pink ladies are now the pink aunties. We just kind of indigenized the whole thing. And finally, from Andrade, even if we had none of that, we have an entire cast and crew of indigenous people being represented on that stage. Even if we had done word-for-word Greece, it would still be spellbinding to see that representation. But it's not just that. And for some combination of reasons that I can't discern right now, the only two articles left for me from this week's issue talk about wine bars. And wine bars are fine by me. Here's one opening at the Passmore House in downtown Cary. That's on South Academy Street, and it has served many functions over the years. Private residence, boarding house for students, most recently a brewery taproom on the edge of downtown Cary Park. Now, with the investment of some fresh paint and upgrades, a couple of longtime Caryites are bringing vino and tap into its next life, opening Thursday, which is the day I'm recording this. The father and son duo behind the new wine and craft beer bar are Drew Schenk, a hospitality veteran who also co-owns Dram and Draft locations, and Robbie Schenk, managing partner and general manager. Vino and Tap will focus on champagne cocktails, a, quote, well-curated tap program, and an extensive wine-by-the-bottle list. Six reds and six whites, one of those might be a rosé, will be by the glass. The house backs up to downtown Cary Park, and the business is built to work with the park's social district. Drew said, everything we sell here can go into the park. That means the champagne cocktails are made with wine-based liqueurs. He envisions Vino and Tap as a bar that attracts regulars through its drinks, accessible price points, and open hours. That includes brunch. And they hope to have brunch-oriented food trucks on Saturdays and Sundays after they open. Coffee will be available by the cup on weekends. French press will be available anytime for those who prefer a cup of something caffeinated in the refreshed space. For those who frequented Cotton House, a brewery tap room that closed in November last year, you'll notice a different theme. Imagine a circa 1900s craftsman-style house, but lived in a few years, with art deco touches, sparkling chandeliers, and deep colors. The double-sided exposed brick fireplace is still there, and the footprint of the house hasn't changed. It's one of the buildings in the Cary Historic District, recognized by the National Register of Historic Places. They want to hearken back to a Victoria era with a 1920s vibe, said Drew. Three separate parlors, each with vignettes of new velvet chairs and couches, take up one side of the interior. The other side is where future patrons will belly up to an updated bar, which includes high-tech wine-chilling equipment. Now, this chilling system is important to Drew, who said the wine program will offer a variety of price points. Each bottle or glass of wine will be served at its correct temperature. Another update to the house includes adding a wine cellar upstairs. An exterior change that prompted long threads of comments by Facebook group members involved the removal of an artistic column made from an old tree. Drew said the base of the former tree had given out, and it was no longer viable to keep, and was returned to the artist. Another oak tree needed to be removed from the front of the house as well. However, the Schenks are working with Trees for the Triangle to install five new trees, two oaks and three tulip poplar. That removal was of high interest in local Facebook groups. Around back, the deck has been painted, updated with railings overlooking the park. Drew and Robbie expect food traffic from downtown Cary Park attendees. That includes families and people with dogs. Vino and Tap is a bar, which means the business is for adults, but kids can come in with parents ordering a beverage or packaged snack before going back outside to the backyard or park. Drew said, we've done this for a long time. It's about hospitality. We want everyone to feel welcome. Drew's background in hospitality and began with an original Remington Grill in Cary 30 years ago. Next, he founded Raleigh Point's Sports Grill in Cary. He sold both. Later, he co-founded Dram and Draft with Kevin Barrett, which has grown to 7 locations in the state. Robbie worked in different roles in food and beverage. It was an opportunity I didn't want to pass up. For Drew, it's an opportunity to do something in downtown Cary for the first time, and it's exciting to do something with Robbie, he said. Okay, here's the details. Fino and Tap, 307 South Academy Street, Cary. After its opening today, the 2nd, hours will be on Tuesdays through Thursdays, 2 to 10 p.m. 12 to 11 p.m. Fridays, 10 a.m. to 11 p.m. Saturdays, and 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Sundays. And with just about 2 minutes left, I've got to curtail some of this article. A new Portuguese-focused wine bar in East Durham. Owner Sergio Ramos. After years of talking about it, he's turned his vision of Portuguese and Spanish varietals into a reality. It's called Pinheiro, P-I-N-H-E-I-R-O. Vinho e Vida opens in March 20th, coming up. Well, it's already open. In East Durham, they are at 304 South Driver Street. That's just near Ideal's Sandwich Shop, Sophia's Pizza, and Dame's Chicken and Waffles. He likes the particular neighborhood community feeling about it. He grew up on Long Island. Parents are from Brazil and Portugal, which is where his love of Portuguese and Spanish wines come from. Received a Certified Specialist of Wine credential from the Society of Wine Educators, followed by a certification of Portuguese wines. In recent years, his bar dreams have expanded. And when I asked him if there's a downside to not playing it safe and, say, offering well-known options like Kim Crawford, Sauvignon Blanc, Ramos said no. Instead, he became animated, explaining how invigorating it is to try to help a customer figure out their palate and what makes them tick. So, as long as you're willing to sample a few options in the quest to find your perfect glass, you're likely to end up with something new that you like. A tough job, but one Ramos is happy to undertake. And once again, that's Vinho e Vida, Pinheiro. That's 304 South Drivers Street. And I apologize for having to wrap that up, as well as this entire issue of the Indie Week. So John Federson here. I should be back, cosmic circumstances permitting, next week for our next weekly podcast, which is now going to be available after our broadcast on Friday. So for Indie Week, the Independent, John Federson in North Carolina Reading Service says so long, folks. Thanks for listening.